Civil liberties are not of much real concern to much of the public. It is pretty clear that we have greater freedom for Americans to speak and write and assemble today than we ever had before. And much of the impetus for a greater range of such freedoms has come from the writer, the artist, the scholar, the journalist, the lawyer. Norman Lear is the executive producer of All in the Family and Maud, successful and significant television series. Mel Nimmer is a law professor at UCLA. He is an expert in the field of civil liberties. Jim Bellows is the associate editor of the Los Angeles Times. For evidence that we are using that greater range of freedom...
Maud, I think it would be wrong to have a child at our age.
Oh, so do I, Walter. Oh, Walter, so do I.
We make awful parents.
Oh, impatient, irascible.
Awful. It's just not our time of life.
Well, for other people it might be fine, but for us, I don't think it would be fair to anybody. Oh, Walter, hold me closer.
Are you frightened, Maud? About the operation, I mean.
Oh, don't be ridiculous, darling. Why should I be frightened? Were you frightened of the vasectomy? I said, were you frightened about the vasectomy?
I didn't have it. You see, I was psychologically unprepared. You can ask Arthur. Uh-huh. Arthur's a doctor.
Honey,
he told me that...
It's all right. It's all right. Just tell me, Walter, that I'm doing the right thing, not having the baby.
For you, Maud, for me, in the privacy of our own lives, you're doing the right thing.
I love you, Walter Finley.
As we mentioned, Norman Lear is the executive producer of Maud. Did you have a bit of a fight getting that segment on the air?
A lot of discussion. I wouldn't call it a fight. A lot of discussion about doing it, but no real fight.
What was the ACLU's role in getting that segment aired?
Well, the ACLU was very instrumental in a fight that ensued when the shows were to be repeated in the summer. And numerous stations were indicating, individual stations, that they weren't going to take the show. And the ACLU took a very strong position about that and notified ACLU members around the country to counter the pressure that was being exerted on the individual affiliate stations to drop the show.
But there's no way that you as executive producer or the ACLU, either one, could dictate the stations that they had to carry that segment, was it?
Well, nobody could dictate that they had to. There was a good deal of pressure not to show the show at all, brought against individual sponsors as well as the affiliates. And the ACLU countered with an equal kind of pressure.
Have you had the same sort of problem with some segments of All in the Family?
No, we haven't.
When Archie Bunker said "God damn" on the air, was that a
difficult
situation?
Well, when Archie Bunker said "God damn it," actually, I had written that into the very first episode, the pilot of the series, 6 years ago, and that was the only thing that we agreed when we went on CBS. Not to air in that very first episode, but with the understanding that I would come back sometime and say, I think now is the time. And it was the first episode of this season. We had some discussion, but again, no fight.
How was the public reaction?
The public reaction has been a very funny show. And it's simply that the networks and a lot of leadership in industry and government don't understand how very grown up this country is.
Mel Nimmer's had a chance to see how very grown up some people in this country are, particularly when it comes to the language you've been involved in defending, symbolic speech, four-letter words. How do you defend those?
Well, Jess, actually, I think one might distinguish between four-letter words, which, as you suggest, I was involved in, a four-letter word on a jacket, which the Supreme Court said is a part of freedom of speech. But then symbolic speech gets to a somewhat different situation, where, for example, wearing a flag as a vest, or flag burning, or burning a draft card, that sort of thing. That gets at the question of what does the First Amendment really protect? Does it protect words as such, or does it protect ideas, the communication of ideas? And more, I think the courts are beginning to see that what we're talking about is the communication of ideas. Indeed, in a sense, all speech is symbolic speech. Right now, I'm moving my mouth up and down, I'm using my vocal cords, I'm making sounds which are symbols that you're able to interpret what those symbols mean. So in that sense, all speech, or if we look at a written word, we see funny little twirlings on a page, which we call letters, and together we call them words. These are symbols, too.
You haven't said a single word that has outraged us, and yet some of your ideas, I'm sure, have outraged many people, particularly the desecration of the flag.
Exactly. I think that's the one that really tests one's understanding of what we're talking about in freedom of speech. Now, when one desecrates a flag, one burns a flag, why do we object to it? We don't object because it's cloth being burned. Nobody objects to cloth being burned. It's the symbolism that the flag stands for. And when we talk about symbolism, by definition, we're talking about the expression of an idea. Now, if someone were to say, I hate the government, we would disagree with him, but everyone would acknowledge, or most people would acknowledge, that's protected by freedom of speech. Why is it different if instead of saying that in words, you express precisely the same idea by an act, where the act itself is not objectionable except for the idea it's conveying? If that's the case, then I think... And I think the ACLU believes, I know the ACLU believes, that this should be regarded as protected speech. Not that we approve of the doing of it, but any more than we approve of saying I hate the government, or I favor Nazis, or whatever. It's not that we approve of the message, we approve of the right of each person to express his idea as he sees fit.
Jim Billis, you've been listening to this. Are they ahead of us in the media when it comes to, for instance, there was a time not long ago when, as I recall, the Los Angeles Times used to airbrush out navels on some of their ads, and obviously you don't use some of the language that is now legal to use publicly.
Well, we'd only use that language, I would guess, if it really fits into a story that somehow is, let's say, a public official.
I saw goddamn in the Los Angeles Times the other day, but it was a small g.
That's possible.
And that's a distinction.
Naturally, we don't spread it all over the pages, that's for sure.
Yeah. Right. Do you find any problem with this? Do you find some of the things that are now being done troublesome to you?
You mean things that are done in the newspapers?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
No, I think that we're pretty much with the times today. I think the whole Watergate thing has shown this. I think it's shown the value of the press. I think we've learned a great deal out of Watergate. I mean, the press itself has learned a great deal. Because I think, in a way, too little of the press was working as hard as it should have been to uncover the Watergate situation.
We had some conversation earlier about a shield law. Do you think an absolute shield law is achievable?
I think it's the only way to do it. In other words, the Supreme Court decision.
But looking at it pragmatically, are we going to get
anything else, really, you're just putting in things that are going to be added to later that you weren't going to wind up with no shield law. And I used to figure 15, 20 years ago that the First Amendment was all we needed. And people that were breastfeeding and so forth about freedom of the speech and freedom of the press were sort of ridiculous. I don't anymore, because we're being harried from the left and the right.
And the courts have pretty clearly indicated that we need...
Yeah, and they're just, some of the prosecutors and some of the lawyers are actually just lazy. Because today, with the electronic world and everything, we have tapes. We have both TV tapes and newspaper journalist tapes. And we didn't have those 30, 50 years ago. And it's much easier for them to do their work. They just call in this reporter to come up here and tell what he knows about the case and send 20 of their investigators out.
It is a problem, perhaps, of educating the people as to the need for shield legislation or the real guarantee of a free society and a free press. And this is the kind of education you, Norman Lear, have been doing in taking social issues and presenting them in the form you do. What have you got planned in the future that's going to shock us or educate us or both?
Well, we don't think we're doing that, actually. We're presenting a half hour of entertainment on these shows.
The piece on alcoholism you did could certainly have been something more than entertainment. You must have had education in mind.
Well, you figure when a man reaches 50 years of age, he's got something else on his mind besides a simple laugh. There, you can make people laugh with something that is of some importance to them. And there are a lot of us who have reached that age where I work, writers, directors, producers, we must comprise a few thousand years. A lot of gray matter there. And we like to think that along with the entertainment, the things we feel, the things we that mean a lot to us, we know mean a lot to a great many other people, and it will entertain them more to have subject matter in those areas.
At least at this point in time, you should pardon expression, it appears the press, the arts, the scholar are all willing to insist on their civil liberties, and for the most part are able to retain them, as we have seen. But there are those who have to be encouraged, who have to be aided. It was all in the South. Then August 1965, Watts. Whether it was Selma and a nonviolent demonstration for equality, or Watts and a violent riot, or as some now like to say, a revolt, the participant often found himself pitted against the police. There were instances of excess on both sides. Marie Funk is director of the Venice Police Practices and Complaint Center. Art Garcia is with the East Los Angeles Police Practices and Complaint Center. Harold Hart Nibrig is now a lawyer, but he formerly directed the Watts Police Practices Center. Gentlemen and lady, what part of the 14th Amendment was involved in what you people were doing?
I would say it's a question of equal protection, mainly, is what is involved.
It was that simple a matter, then?
Yes, I think so.
And there was not equal protection?
Exactly. In other words, the police will treat different people differently in the street.
How do you go about countering that kind of thing, other than in the courts?
Well, at the centers, we try to do it in various ways. The simplest way, of course, is to simply find out who the offending officer was and reporting it to a superior. If it's the matter of the LAPD, we will go through the police commission and ask that someone investigate that incident. Unfortunately, this doesn't work out too well because when we report these incidents, the person who does the investigating is a brother officer, and it doesn't really work out too well. But we can hope that will change.
Art, I assume it was a similar situation in your judgment than in East Los Angeles. How do you go about it? Do you accept the word of those who come in and complain? How much investigation did you do of that? How certain were you that the complaint was legitimate?
Well, we have, in our office, we have about 15, 16 law students. We have college students who also come in to assist us in conducting investigations, going out to the scene, talking to witnesses, referring people to doctors, gathering all the information that we need to prepare a case. And if we feel that the complaint is legitimate, we will take steps to try and assist that person, maybe by providing an attorney for him.
Now, Marie talked about the fact that complaints were, when they got to the police department, were investigated by fellow officers. Yours was not an entirely objective source either, was it? Wouldn't other students have a tendency to side with the complainant and to try to find a substantiation of the complaint and perhaps be too sympathetic?
Well, with a police department, you usually find that it's a sergeant in the station who's conducting the investigation. And their word to the community is that we are conducting these investigations to try and discipline the police officer. At times when we've been in court trying to produce, trying to get the police to produce those investigations, we found that the city attorney and the county council were both coming back with that the primary purpose of these investigations is to protect the city and county of Los Angeles from any civil liability.
In East Los Angeles, you were dealing, what, largely with the sheriff's office rather than the police?
Well, both, the sheriff's
Could you make
department
a distinction?
And the LAPD.
Can you make an evaluation which was easier to deal with? With which did you have fewer problems?
Well, lately we've been on better terms with the sheriff's department. They've been willing to give us certain information. They've allowed us to view some information that they've gathered in conducting their investigations. The Los Angeles Police Department, though, won't give us any information at all.
I know a police officer, Harold, who will not say American Civil Liberties Union. He will only say Civil Liberties Union, and he makes a point of it because he says it is not American. How do you counter that, and how do you avoid being being anti-police?
Well, when I was active as director of that office, I did not avoid being anti-police.
You were openly anti-police?
Openly anti-police. We had different definitions. None of us, and no ACLU person, and to my knowledge, has ever complained of the existence of police departments recognizing certain needs. Our attack, our activities were directed solely at malpractice, and that included the most brutal kinds, the death of individual in questionable circumstances. And when directing our efforts in this way, there was no question but we were anti-police. We are probably the most American or a classic example of a group that might fit that label, American. The whole point is defense of constitutional principles. Now, for us, it took a very, had a very pragmatic atmosphere. We were not, at that time, in courts arguing these principles. We were working, like many ACLU people do, with victims at the very first levels, investigating their complaints, their charges, keeping them active on their own cases, letting them know there was somebody there to help, finding witnesses, and getting these things before the proper bodies.
You didn't always win. The courts
we very
and
seldom
juries
won.
Frequently went against you.
Yeah, we very seldom won in terms of having a court find against a an officer or a group of officers for a particular case of malpractice. But we won a number of other things. We defended a lot of people. We won their individual criminal charges in many cases, as they proved to be non-existent when the facts came out. We also established, ACLU established through these offices, a contact with communities in Los Angeles that they didn't have before, a continuation of their people work that they've always had. And that has been a major victory, and I think put ACLU on the record.
Marie, police officers, many young ones, say that one of their big problems is they go into South Central Los Angeles and they cannot deal, particularly with young people in that area, on occasion because they have been told, the young people have been told, that the police do have a double standard, that the police are not going to be fair, the police are not going to be honest with them. Are you guilty of having caused that kind of attitude in South Central Los Angeles, if I can play devil's advocate?
Well, of course, I don't deal with people in South Central Los Angeles. It's mostly on the west side, primarily the Venice Division. And I can only talk about that.
Okay.
But it's the same sort of situation,
yes. Exactly.
No, I don't think the young people needed someone like us to come along and tell them how the police misbehaved, because they can see it for themselves every day, firsthand. And this is very unfortunate.
You don't think that there's any child down there whose first encounter with the policeman is frightening because what he has been told about policemen, what he has read and about policemen?
It could be, but I think he has seen enough that he knows that he's frightened of a policeman, because he sees a policeman breaking the law very frequently.
There is no conciliation in your tone. Art, there is an alien problem in East Los Angeles. The insistence that aliens are being hassled by police out there. How do you deal with that kind of situation?
Well, I really haven't been involved too much with the alien problem. We have a center out in East Los Angeles. It's known as One Stop Immigration, and they've been taking and, you know, dealing with the immigration problem. But the American Civil Liberties Union itself has been quite a bit involved in dealing with that. I believe they brought a suit in court against the officers from immigration and other federal officers.
Does not come into police malpractice then, or the police practices agency? It is just with the ACLU then?
Well, the ACLU, I think, took it on as a special project of their own.
Okay. Public passion and prejudice were certainly involved in the civil rights demonstrations, but some could argue that public passion and prejudice reached an even greater peak in related cases that involved neither blacks nor the oppressed. Daniel Ellsberg has been variously glorified as a dedicated, selfless patriot and vilified as a traitor. Jim Thompson, a veteran, served his nation, then with Vietnam Veterans Against the War, opposed its government, its policies. The Vietnam War, this nation's longest war, produced more and more dissent the longer it continued. Perhaps no figure is more clearly associated with that dissent than Daniel Ellsberg. Dr. Ellsberg, you had the charges against you dropped. The mistrial was declared. Are you satisfied with the results that came out of your trial?
Well, certainly. I didn't think there should have been a trial. And certainly there shouldn't have been the kind of governmental misconduct that the judge rightly condemned in it. So I think he was certainly right to have ended the trial when he did.
Do you think the subsequent action, which we're still going through, the investigation of the break-in at the psychiatrist's office, is going to be a step toward greater civil liberty or a greater guarantee of existing civil liberties?
Certainly the act that was taken was a terrible violation of individual privacy and of rights, and that's got to be deterred in the future. I must say that there's an irony as I've been reading the indictment, as I look at it in the light of my own case, to say that copying of information constitutes theft of that information, if that is implied in the indictment, I think is a violation of the First Amendment, and I can't believe that would be legal.
Was that question never resolved in your case?
It wasn't because of the governmental misconduct, including this burglary, but other things as well. Now, I've used the word burglary, and what I'm doing is raising the question as to whether it is properly regarded as burglary if there was only copying. That isn't to say there may not or must have been other crimes, federal crimes of invasion of privacy or violation of my civil rights, breaking and entering and so forth. But to say that the transfer of information is a criminal act of theft, which seems implied in that indictment, I think is to abridge very greatly the flow of information in this country, and it's my impression that that's not the law.
Unlike most of those with whom the ACLU becomes involved, I suspect, you welcome trial. You really rather looked forward to it as an opportunity to express dissent, to express a point of view, did you not?
No.
You did not welcome trial.
I would have been very foolish to have welcomed trial.
As I recall, the days before trial, you said you were looking forward to it as an opportunity to.
I will say, well, given that I was put on trial, and I would have this attitude again, I hoped that we'd make the most of it as citizens on the defense team, and use it to expose issues of freedom of speech, of aspects of the war to the public. But I never regarded a courtroom as my chosen forum. It wasn't my chosen forum, and the prosecutor chooses it, and he knows why he chooses it. He sets the rules. I don't regard it as a forum for education primarily. You get what you can out of it. It's primarily a matter for a place where matters of law and law violation are settled. And that's the way I looked at it. So I didn't look forward to it, and I would have been very disappointed if I had. It's an unpleasant process and a very straining process. One can be very glad that organizations like the ACLU are around for defendants, but they don't make it into a pleasant matter.
Your dissent was frequently, was generally very scholarly, very logical, the dissent of Vietnam Veterans Against the War was not always that. Frequently, it was angry, loud, occasionally profane. Is that tactic one you would have chosen, Jim?
What, the profaneness or going to trial?
No, going to the streets in demonstration.
Well, there's always been time for demonstrations in the United States. It's one of our constitutional rights. And it's a very visible way of showing, you know, that we are upset with what's occurring. The case with Vietnam Veterans Against the War Winter Soldier Organization was that we had been in a war. We had served either in the States or in Vietnam ourselves, and we had been lied to. We were very much victims of the Johnson administration and of the Nixon administration, and we were showing that we had been lied to, and we were trying to tell the American people
you know, that we had been lied to, and to tell them the real story of what happened in Vietnam.
Think part of this, that talk a bit about the Gainesville trial.
Well, the Gainesville trial was a one in a series of trials that's been conducted by the Nixon administration. The first one was the Chicago trial of 1969, where grand juries were used, first off, to gain indictments in left organizations or progressive organizations, anti-war movement in general. And then at that time, indictments were handed down, and they were put into trial. And what this did was drain the movement of a lot of money and a lot of time. We spent an enormous amount of money and an enormous amount of time in the Gainesville case trying to prove the innocence of the Gainesville Eight. And in the end, it turned out like all of the other trials, Chicago, Harrisburg, and one of the most interesting ones was the Camden 23 trial, where the case was thrown out of court solely on the basis that there were FBI informants in the Camden 23.
But nobody was ever convicted. Does that illustrate to us that our civil liberties are safe?
I would hate to say that, because the fact that we were put on to trial, the fact that there were those eight conspiracy trials, say something about the tactic, the misuse of the grand juries. So I don't know whether our civil liberties are safe.
There are also those who would say, though, that, and this applies to you as well as to Dr. Ellsberg, that while you perhaps were not guilty of the crime with which you were charged, maybe you were charged with the wrong crime. Is that a possibility?
It's possible, although in our case, no one has ever come up. I think I wouldn't fault the prosecution for doing about as well as they could, trying to find a crime of which we'd been guilty, but they failed. No one's ever brought to our attention a statute that we'd violated.
We have been dealing with civil liberties mostly from the outside. We've turned now to those who are not at liberty, those who are in prison. Have they civil rights? The cries and the shouts we're hearing from behind prison walls are insisting, yes. The ACLU has programs in various communities that involve prisoners' rights. Linda Hunt is chairman of the Riverside ACLU. Bruce Derflinger is chairman of the Orange County ACLU. And Brad Curry is the president of the Santa Barbara ACLU. They're all three laymen, and they are working on the issue of prisoners' rights. And we talked a bit about the ACLU getting involved in unpopular causes, and I dare say, especially in Orange County, yours might be an unpopular cause.
Extremely so. A person hasn't lost their humanity or their right as a citizen of the United States when they're arrested and put in jail. In fact, most of the people I would say that are in jail are there waiting short time for their trials to come up. They haven't been convicted yet. They've just been accused. And these people are the people who seem to have the most problem, because they're sitting there waiting for their trials, and they have a hard time realizing that or adjusting to the life they've been thrown into.
What do you tell people who, Linda, who insist that with the continuing growth of the crime rate, we are being not too hard but too soft on prisoners, that we let them out too soon, that they are coddled, that there is not sufficient punishment to deter crime?
Well, the prisoners who are within the prison walls, as Bruce was saying, have rights. They should not be defined simply as constitutional rights or civil rights, but they're human rights. And I think that it is up to people like us in our society who are out free walking the streets to provide the greatest opportunity for them to develop into fulfilled human beings while they're in prison. So that once they get out, if you just simply want to look at it from a pragmatic point of view, they'll be productive, they'll be able to enter back into society, and they'll be able to contribute back to us. If we continually deny them their rights to develop, to grow, to become good, worthwhile human beings, then we have done nothing but turn them into animals, and we have to deal with that again once they're back out on the streets.
Graduate schools for crime, some have called them.
Most.
Definitely.
How are you doing in Santa Barbara?
Well, we're fortunate in Santa Barbara to have a new sheriff who rejects warehousing of prisoners completely. And our ACLU chapter has taken advantage of that fact and has been working with the sheriff and the new jailer in the development of a pioneer program. What it would entail is a federal grant to do at the county jail level what they do at the state prison level, which is analyze the prisoners as they come in to see who needs psychiatric help, who needs vocational training, who needs further education, and so on. And we have worked for the sheriff to develop a citizens advisory committee on corrections, and ACLU will be represented on that, along with a criminologist from UCSB and a psychologist, and so on.
Was a great deal learned from the student disorder at UCSB?
Yes, as a matter of fact, our new sheriff came out of that, and one of the men on the corrections board is a student, former student, who was arrested, put in our county jail for 6 months for setting fire to a trash can. He holds a BA in sociology, and he's going to also be on that commission as a former inmate. So we learned a great deal from that.
Southern California is hardly like the area where you have a chain gang, and we have pretty fair physical facilities, it seems to me, for maintaining prisons. Orange County, for instance, has a brand new county jail, doesn't it?
Very true, but in some sections reminds me of a medieval dungeon. We have a number of prisoners which formed a group called the Friends and Relations, Friends and Families of the Prisoners of Orange County Jail. Because a number of the prisoners had been tossed into solitary confinement, or the hole as they call it, without a hearing, without being given any reason for it, and spent, we had one person who was claiming 60 days in jail without seeing anybody, in the hole without seeing anybody, occasionally receiving a square or two of toilet paper, no toothbrush, and meals once, sometimes twice a day. And we feel this is pretty much of an inhumane treatment, especially in light of today's civilization.
The theme that has run through this entire program is that the ACLU espouses unpopular causes. In Riverside County, is yours an unpopular cause?
Yes, and it's growing more and more unpopular every day, it seems.
Why so?
Sometimes. Well, that's a very hard question to answer. Riverside is kind of a rural area, and it's difficult to produce any change in an area like that without creating some controversy. This fall, last fall before the election, we went into the county detention facilities and registered over 400 inmates to vote. And this, you know, some people don't feel that men and women detained in county detention facilities should have the right to vote. And this, though it seems to many of us to be a very rational approach to returning some of the rights to the prisoners. To others, it seemed as though it was just another sort of liberal tactic to get...
Now, all three of you are dealing with local situations. You're dealing with county jails, largely, rather than the larger state prisons. Are you involved at all in those? Do you have any involvement with families of prisoners who are involved there?
Yes, we have an organization which I mentioned before, the Friends and Relatives of Prisoners in the Orange County Jail, which is expanded to include all the jails in Orange County, and it's an ongoing...
But not the state prison system?
No, state prison system we pretty much leave to the affiliate because we haven't got the manpower to overlook the state facilities, and I really haven't got too much of a state facility down in Orange County, mostly just the local type jails.
What extent do you get feedback, and this could certainly be true in Santa Barbara too, when a paroled prisoner comes out of jail and commits another crime? Public reaction has got to be against anything that is favorable to the prisoner, even needed and guaranteed civil rights. How do you counter that? Do you feel any responsibility for that?
Yes, but we feel there's a growing awareness, both in the public and on the part of law enforcement, that to do an effective job with a prisoner, they're going to have to be more humane than they have in the past. The business of warehousing a man or mistreating him, or the punitive aspects of jail have to go if they're going to be effective. And the captain of the jail told me that just this week. He says, we realize we're selfish in the humane new treatment that we're developing because we can be more effective that way.
Thank you very much. In looking at these 50 years, the ACLU has been involved in the fight for civil liberties. There have been a number of changes, and some involve the ACLU's attitudes. But the American Civil Liberties Union has not been alone in that fight. 20 years ago, another fighter for liberty raised his voice.
Did I dream you could be so reckless and so cruel as to do an injury to that lad? It is true he is still with Hale and Dorr. It is true that he will continue to be with Hale and Dole. It is, I regret to say, equally true that I fear he shall always bear a scar needlessly inflicted by you. If it were in my power to forgive you for your reckless cruelty, I would do so. I like to think I'm a gentle man, but your forgiveness will have to come from someone other than me.
Mr. Chairman, now I just give this man's record, and I want to say, Mr. Welch, that it has been labeled long before he became a member, as early as 1944.
Senator, may we not drop this? We know he belonged to the Lawyers Guild. And Mr. Cole nods his head at me. I did you, I think, no personal injury, Mr. Cole.
No, sir.
I meant to do you no personal injury. And if I did, I beg your pardon. Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness.
20 years ago. Looking back on that and looking forward to the future is Marvin Schachter, who is the president of the Southern California ACLU, and joining us once again, the executive director, Ramona Ripston. Mr. Schachter, I talked a bit about the fact that there is not total agreement in the ACLU, and what do you say to those people who are critical of your organization for not having taken a stand on, say, the death penalty a long time ago?
Well, we're proud of the fact that here in Southern California, the ACLU was the first part of the entire organization that said the death penalty was a civil liberties issue because of the way it was applied, because of the people who were affected by it. And the ACLU, the interesting thing about the ACLU is that it is an organization which has lots of controversy within it. And as I say, here in Southern California, with a somewhat maverick kind of organization, we are proud of the fact that we have initiated many of the programs and policies that the ACLU as a whole now adopts.
What program now is causing the greatest dissent in your organization?
I would say perhaps around the issue of President Nixon and Watergate. The ACLU of Southern California was the first part of the ACLU to condemn the war in Vietnam as an unconstitutional war. And we've been very happy about the fact that we were able, after long debate, to convince the entire organization that this was an unconstitutional war, and the ACLU opposed the war. Right now, the Southern California ACLU is going to bring to the national board of the ACLU, board in which I sit, a proposal that we support the impeachment of President Nixon because we believe the activities that have been conducted by the administration are unconstitutional and threaten the foundations of American freedom. Well, there's not a lot of agreement about that. It's
your
a very
membership.
controversial question. But we're not afraid of controversy here in Southern California.
Even within your own organization.
That's right.
Ramona, abortion has got to be an issue that there is not unanimity among members of the ACLU on either.
Oh, I would say there's probably a great deal of unanimity among our members about a woman's right to do with her body what she chooses. I think that's something that the ACLU has felt rather strongly about for a long period of time. We really have a sizable women's rights docket, and I don't want to let an opportunity go by to talk about it, both here in L.A. and nationally. And here in L.A., we are trying to sexually integrate the police department, and very soon we will be having a full-scale trial and the issue of whether or not women can walk the beat and do all the things that male officers do will be litigated.
On this issue of women, and back to the abortion issue, there surely are Catholic women in your organization who cannot accept the ACLU's position on abortion.
Well, I think I see the hate mail that comes into the organization, and believe me, we get a lot of it. But more of it, I think abortion is an issue that we really, for members anyway, haven't had too much hate mail. I think that there are many Catholic women who really feel, although they may not want to have an abortion themselves, they feel that it is right for another woman, and that they don't want to deny another woman who wants to have an abortion that right. And I think that we have
You know, we had a Jesuit priest who sat on our national organization's board who took that position, that while he personally did not believe in abortion, he felt it was wrong to prevent some other person from having an abortion if that's what she wanted.
I would assume that, by and large, most members of the ACLU would consider themselves liberals. And yet you've got to take positions that aren't necessarily liberal positions. What about the right to bear arms?
Well, Jeff, I want to emphasize this. The ACLU was really a, it's not a non-political organization because we participate in the political process, but we're a non-partisan organization. And there's room within the ACLU for people of any kind of political belief, and conservatives as well as liberals.
Strict adherence to the Constitution can be a very conservative position.
Absolutely. If one emphasizes the importance of conserving American freedom and conserving the right of privacy, we find that sometimes we have bedfellows people don't expect. Just recently here in California, we were participants with the California Bankers Association in a suit to protect the right of privacy of bank accounts. And we acted then on behalf of bankers as well as the individual citizen.
Are you overlooking or ignoring my question about arms?
Oh, arms? Well, I think...
I want to be sure.
Yes, I think that on that question there is general agreement within the ACLU. We support the concept of arms control, of gun control.
You don't think
society.
The Constitution...
we don't, because we think the Constitution clearly says that the right to bear arms is in relation to the right to have a militia, a National Guard, citizens under arms in a military sense, rather than the right to have personal arms in a way that, as we've seen, unfortunately, has often been used mostly against members of one's own family, against rather than an intruder.
Jess, could I say something? You asked Art Garcia a few minutes ago about what the ACLU was doing about the alien question, and he didn't talk about something that I think is very significant that we're doing. We filed a suit challenging the indiscriminate roundup of people of brown skin. Downtown, where our office is, people are stopped and just picked up in dragnet arrests all the time based merely on skin color. And it's the ACLU's position that immigration officials and police do not have the right to do that unless they have probable cause to believe that someone is here illegally. And so I just wanted you to know that that's what we're doing about the alien problem.
Is there unanimity there, as a matter of fact, while we're talking about these disputes over this? A lot of Mexican-Americans would like to see greater roundups of illegal aliens. I realize your position is that you should not indiscriminately round up everyone who looks Mexican-American.
Well, I doubt, and Marvin, you know, you can neither bear this out or disagree with me, I doubt that we have unanimity on any single issue within the ACLU. And in some ways, it's really the beauty of the ACLU. The fact that the Bill of Rights and the Constitution is a constantly changing thing, open to new interpretations, about which we, within our own ACLU family, have all sorts of disagreements. And I think that makes us, you know, alive and vital.
Perhaps the biggest controversial issue within the ACLU was simply on the question of the concept of civil liberties. I think American freedom has been an expanding kind of concept as a whole. And in the ACLU, we believe very strongly in that. So we say, yes, we fight to defend the rights of Americans as listed in the Bill of Rights, but we also fight for an expanding concept of freedom so all Americans, and yes, aliens too, have rights that are human rights in our society. And of course, when we have these kinds of discussions and these kinds of debates within our own organization, there are disagreements expressed. But that's part of the healthy nature, I think, of the American Civil Liberties Union.
I thank you both for joining us. I thank you all.
Thank you.
Some who have praised the American Civil Liberties Union have also said they wish we didn't have a need for the ACLU. But there is a general recognition that liberties not used, not defended, are liberties that are soon worn away. The ACLU will very likely continue to be a subject of dispute. It will have its supporters, and it'll also have those who decry it. The ACLU is audacious, aggressive, and sometimes abrasive. But it thrives on controversy, and it endures. Perhaps in part because of the ACLU, our civil liberties also endure. In this, the 50th anniversary of the American Civil Liberties Union, we're glad to acknowledge that.